This show is brought to you by Pizza Pizza.
Pizza Pizza. The pizza's so nice, they named it twice.
When it's 2 a.m. in the morning and Domino's won't pick up, and you can't quite get to Little Caesars, Pizza Pizza.
Pizza Pizza. Sometimes you just order in.
Pizza Pizza. Because you love yourself, but like not that much.
Okay.
Wah ba boom 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 ba boom
ba boom ba boom ba boom ba boom. All right, that was awesome.
I think that's the best one we've done so far.
Yeah, that was amazing.
I'll take personal credit for that.
No, that's why it was the best one we've done so far, really.
Yeah, in the studio with us this week, we're really excited about it. We actually mentioned it on last week's show. If anyone remembers, we have Mika Barnes. Am I pronouncing that right?
Mika, you got it.
Okay, just making sure.
Yeah.
Mika Barnes has a new record out, New York Stories. When did this come out?
Actually, it's 2 years old now. Last January we were picked up by a distributor, E1 Music, but then it had been out as an indie for about a year.
You
know how it is these days. It's in stages that you release.
Oh yeah,
right?
we're trying to get in the stages. he's on the show today because he's on a national tour. This is actually a recording because he actually played last week.
Not tell them that.
Oh, they can know. If you guys caught him, I'm sure you know. It's amazing. Yeah. But we're gonna take the full story, and that's going to be the first half hour of our show today.
Yes.
And yeah, we're going to get the full story from the man himself. Yeah. So, Raz, what's the first question we want to ask?
Well, see, in my opinion, when you're talking about a musician and to a musician, it's really important to know where they come from, what their inspirations are. So, Mika, I'd like to start with you right from the beginning. Tell me about the first time you ever picked up an instrument.
Oh, my goodness. Oh, I don't remember because I was so young. Well, see, my dad was a classical composer who had been a jazz drummer. Right. So he was like he was just at the piano all the time. Mm-hmm. So probably like, I mean, my crib was under the piano. Like my parents were students when they had me. So like there wasn't a lot of money and there wasn't a babysitter. You know, I was just under the piano because I would fall asleep to him practicing. Right. So I probably started playing piano when I was really, before I could, really knew what I was doing. And I started to improvise, pretend operas and a pretend thing, just improvising when I was little. But then I started to sing when I was about 10, 11, I started to sing and I was I need to be able to make music to accompany myself. And so I went over to the piano and just hacked away at it.
That's great.
And so that's what started it.
Yeah.
Would you say that was around the time you first really figured out that you wanted to do something with music, that you felt that calling really?
I was probably 12, 13 when it took over my brain and my bloodstream. And I was, in a rock and roll band with my buddies at school by age 13,
Oh, wow.
It was very exciting.
Yeah.
But there was a rock and roll band, but we were the glitter rock punk rock band.
Okay, so the best kind of rock.
You
yes.
know what I mean?
Yeah.
We certainly felt that way.
Yeah.
we could tell which girls were fans of which rock band at school.
Yeah, you can always tell.
You could tell.
Did you make your own music when you were that young, or was it?
No, we were covers. So okay. we were like, and Howard Pope, Carol Pope's younger brother, was our guitar player. He'd come in this is the new record by Lou Reed. We'd be like, we're going to pretend to know who Lou Reed is.
That's great. Oh man, Carol Pope is fantastic.
She is. Well, she's just my Howard's kooky older sister to me.
Yeah, wow.
So then let's get into your early influences and your early influences.
Sure. Influences on the influences.
Yeah.
Well, we know what happened. My mom bought a Billie Holiday record for my stepfather.
Okay.
He's a very jazz household. Mm-hmm. My dad, my stepfather played saxophone. My little brother was a drummer. My mom's mom was a concert pianist, but she was a beatnik jazz freak, right? So I walk into this world, and in this world, suddenly Billie Holiday is introduced, and I went, I'm quitting my rock band. I'm going home. I told the guys, right. I'm quitting rock and roll, and I'm going home to become a jazz artist. And they, laughed me out of the garage, And I went and did it.
Yeah. That's quite early for jazz, though, right?
Yeah.
Well, I was stupid. But, you know, I literally felt like Ms. Holiday was speaking to me through the grooves. I felt like she was going, you come here, white boy. I'm going to tell you what to do. You know?
Yeah, absolutely. I can relate to that. When music speaks to you in a way, like I understand people will often have this criticism about music and musicians, in that there's almost this like, oh, come on now, music doesn't speak, but it does. Like, let's
doesn't it?
It totally speaks to you.
Wild, right?
Yeah. What's your instrument of choice, man?
Well, my voice. You know, like I'm not like a spectacular piano player. You know, I'm blessed with having the bare bones of a playing style, so I can like accompany myself. Some of my, you know, shows are just me. Mm-hmm. But then, you know, I can also like hack together an arrangement on the piano.
Okay.
The main thing though is like, it's my singing voice. Like that's the thing that made me do this. Like I just had to sing.
Right.
Yeah.
So, did you then, like, it's interesting that you, you know, talk about your voice as an instrument. I feel like a lot of people wouldn't perhaps say it's an instrument, even though it very much is, right?
Right.
So, why do you say, like, why do you look at it as an instrument?
Well, you know, at the beginning, I mean, I had a big bull moose of an ugly voice when I started. Like, I did, you know, no training, just desire. And there was something, I was just hungry to express the music. So, if it expresses music, then it's an instrument. And then as I trained it, you know, and I got it to the point where I could like, you know, sort of trust it to do things and make it do what I wanted, you know, then like, you know, because you carve into your technique and you create a sustainable technique, it's still an instrument, you know, because that's what you're working with musically, right?
Absolutely.
Especially the way you utilize it. Like you can... Just the beat you made for our little intro song, you can really utilize like your voice as an instrument. Like it's quite...
Definitely.
Yeah.
Well, and the nylons taught me that, right?
Yeah, very true, very true. Yeah.
Which is... I really like what you said, though, about when you were growing up and starting out, it was just desire, no training. Mm-hmm. I feel like you summed up all musicians, like you're starting up musicians.
Totally.
It's that desire, that unbridled desire, but there's often issue with training. Shall we jump into the nylon years?
Yeah, sure.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So let's talk about that. How'd you get yourself involved with that, and what was your experience like there?
You guys are going to laugh. When I was 20, okay, well, how old was I? I might have been 18. I was 18 when they were looking for their bass singer. Mm-hmm. And I am not a bass singer. I'm a baritone. But then at the time, at age 18, I was probably still a tenor. You know what I mean? I didn't have the chest warmth.
Right.
I was all, hi, everyone, you know. Anyway, there I was auditioning with the guys. They stuck a huge joint in my mouth. literally at hello. Like, hey, come on in. And I got so crazy ripped that there was no way on hell I was going to, like, make a harmony. Like, so then they went, like, just, you know, jam with us. And they start, like, making me sing. And I'm, like, thinking, oh, I should be at the bottom. I'm the bass. So I'm, like, with my little boy voice trying to be, boop, 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 trying to sound low, you know. Oh, anyway, crap. So, but they remembered me. And then, like, I became famous on the Toronto scene as a, like, a funk, R&B, rock and roll guy.
Okay.
You know, and I was baritone. And I was, like, you know, this guy that they'd heard about. So their management called me when they were looking to replace the original baritone. And, I mean, he said, like, you know, we know, because I lived on Spadina near where one of them lived. They were musical theater guys, kind of from the generation older than me.
Okay.
Right? Yeah, so they were, they were my hometown heroes, right? Like, I took my brothers to go see them in concert. I'm like, the Nylons, wait till you see it, you know? Yeah. Like, I was proud of them, you know what I mean? They were, like, one of the acts that had kind of carved something out. And they called me, they auditioned me, they put me through, like, a 3-week boot camp. Oh, my God.
What was that like?
Hell.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was eating for stress. I was probably like a big fat guy by the time we were done. You know what I mean?
What kind of training did you have to do in that kind of thing?
Well, I'd never sung harmony.
Okay.
And it's a 4-part a cappella harmony group, right? Plus, I was not a trained dancer, and they needed me to be able to pull off the choreography, which, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So tell a joke, introduce a tune, be a personality, dance while you're singing harmonies, like be a lead singer, be a backup. They just needed to test me because like it was a heavy gig. I was stepping into, you know, like concertizing, you know, 200 shows a year, make a new record, be in business with an 11 staff organization, and I was like young. I was kind of like a young Turk in my mind, you know. I was like, yeah, you need me. I'm gonna come and sing in your little group. And then they were like, yeah, trounce. Try this, motherfucker. And I was like, okay. So I kind of got my eyes open to how hard the gig was, you know.
How young were you at that time?
20s, late 20s, you know. So I was like, but still thinking like, you know, you need me.
Yeah, absolutely. And like, I feel like that's where, you know, you had kind of a little bit of a transition from like soul musician to almost entertainer.
Totally.
Right? How'd you find that transition? Did you struggle with that a little bit at the start? Or?
You know what? I'm so glad you asked, because I started out in cabaret before I went rock and roll, right? Yeah. So like this whole music that I make now with the jazz twist, its roots are in combination of jazz and cabaret. So I was used to entertaining a room. Right. I just wasn't used to entertaining like thousands and thousands and thousands of people in the room, you know? Yeah. So it was about taking my personality and really working with it and making sure I fit the groove of the act.
Right.
So I wouldn't interrupt what was already working about the act and just try to put my own spin on things, you know? And I was a little bit more rock and roll than the rest of the guys, so that kind of worked in our favor, and that we were, you know, we made some pop records, you know?
Yeah, you can, like, bring more to the table that way. It's always, yeah, for sure. You know?
Did you think that, you know, you just touched upon, you were used to entertaining people, but not used to entertaining for thousands of times
right.
in one night.
Yikes.
Room, right? That, like, that, you know, and a lot of people say it, when you do entertain massive crowds, you kind of lose that intimacy.
Yeah.
Did you struggle that a little bit?
I did.
The intimacy factor? How important is that to you? To
be really important. It's why I do jazz, right?
Right.
It's like, I like a smaller room. I like the relationship between me and an audience member. You know, it's huge. Like, a small hall is kind of ideal for me. So what happened was, I would go out there and I wouldn't be able to feel the music. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I wouldn't be able to feel my camaraderie with the guys. And I would feel lost, you know, when my adrenaline's pumping. I'm trying to give a good big rock show. And then I would miss the intimacy, and I wouldn't know if I'd reached anybody, you know?
Yeah, right.
Yeah, so that was hard for me. A big adjustment. I remember we did our first amphitheater for, like, some big event in Minneapolis. And I was so excited and blah, blah, blah. We get out there, and, like, I couldn't hear. You know, it was a huge slap back.
Wow,
I couldn't hear, you know, and the guys were like, and I got back out and I was like, oh my God, where were you guys? I couldn't feel you. I couldn't hear anything. They were like, yeah, no, we know you couldn't hear because you're singing crazy. And then they were like, when it happens that you have huge room that you're dealing with, go intimate. Pull in, be just the four of us. Mm-hmm. So I really learned the skill set of pull into the intimacy of with the players.
Very interesting.
Yeah.
And that's what I do now with my band when I'm in a larger venue and I'm feeling like it's getting away from us. I pull into that and I bring the audience into that intimacy, you know?
Yeah, because the audience can, like, tell too, because I've been to, like, quite a few concerts, some in the ACC, some in just like Massey Hall, which is a lot more intimate.
Yeah.
And the audience can definitely tell when it's like, when it's more of a, like, personal show for them, which is
for
great
sure.
that you can kind of take that big stadium packed with people and just kind of make it just about them, you know?
That's
like,
it.
That's definitely a skill set that you need.
Well, that's interesting you're saying that, because you guys were talking about the voice as the instrument. In a way, the audience is my instrument, too.
Hmm.
You know, like, we're playing together. I'm going to touch your heart, maybe make you upset, get you to remember some shit.
Yeah.
Maybe we're going to have a good time,
right.
You know, together. It's definitely like date night with Mika. Like, it's you and me, right? So let's go on a ride together,
true.
You know?
Right. Yeah. So let's talk about you deciding that you want, you know, when did you decide that, okay, this chapter of my life has now come to an end. I'm going to move on from here. What made you decide that? And where did you think you were going to go after that?
It's a great question. I was in a Holiday Inn, an airport Holiday Inn somewhere, and I didn't have the itinerary. We were in the middle of 10 tour dates. I was exhausted. I was lonely. I was effed up. I just was like not okay in my head or my heart, and I didn't know where I was. And I was listening to some couple screwing in the room next to us. Do you know what I mean? You know how that sounds awful? So like, oh.
Yeah.
It's not actually even hot. It's
no.
Awkward.
Yeah, awkward.
Yeah.
And I'm alone. Yeah. And I'm nowhere. I don't even know where I am. I look out. I can't tell. It's all tarmac and concrete. And I didn't even know how to get a hold of my road manager because there was no itinerary.
Right.
I thought, I hate my life.
Yeah.
And I'm going to go and sing the show that I've been singing for 5 years. I'm done. I didn't leave right away. It took time. But I knew in my heart I had to put my feet on the ground. I needed to, like, retouch the soil that borne me, you know, and come back into myself.
Did it, like, when you made that, when you finally, like, actually made the departure, did it help that you were... that you were in the group to, like, kind of get some bearings and, like, have your foot in the door at some place?
Yeah, that's really true. My initial independent record that I made, the executive producer had just finished working on a Nylons record, and we started working together.
Nice.
So that was good. And the producer had also just been working with the guys. So it did help. And a lot of the connections that I had through the group, because we were touring 80% of the time in the States. So I logically moved to Los Angeles to work with my brand new playmates, you know?
Very interesting. Hmm. So I really want to touch upon something you said. You know, you talked about wanting to get your feet on the soil again.
Yeah.
That connection. And, like, you know, it seems like the 5 years of touring really kind of took away, like, it at you a little bit. And you're kind of, like, losing yourself.
Yeah.
So that process of, like, okay, you have to find yourself again and really get in touch with your music and yourself, was that, like, the first show you did by yourself? Was that immediately, or was it, like, take a little time?
Well, that's beautiful that you ask. It was a big, long time. Like, I was doing solo shows at the piano, which is what I do in between projects. Like, when it's time for me to put my feet on the soil, as it were, I go back to the piano, I book some solo shows, and I work it out, you know, work it out.
Yeah.
And that's what I did. And then at that point, the music started to suggest which way it was going to go. It was all teenage angsty stuff, so we brought in the rock and roll beats, started sampling and involving hip-hop and club elements into the music, because very that. And that's kind of how I launched in the States as a solo guy. And it was because the soil was about my healing. I needed to take care of myself.
Right. I suspect that's where most, like, the greatest music comes from, right?
Oh, yeah.
And that a lot of musicians who feel like their music comes from a place of healing, and you can hear their pain and their recovery. I think audiences can really, relate to that.
So true.
Did you notice that type of vibe in the rooms you were playing?
Yeah, absolutely. The record that I brought home to Canada was just called Mika Barnes, and it was me at the piano. Once again, going back to that piano, right?
Right.
When I was recording it, before I made the record, I started to play out of town. So drive about half hour out of LA into these little rooms where I would, like, just play the songs and see what was landing with people, you know? Mm. And as that landed for me, it became the record that I would bring back to Canada, and that started me back on the jazz trajectory, actually.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
Do you have, it's probably a tough question, but is there any one show in that time period that stands out to you as, like, the one show that you will always remember?
Wow. Yeah. Well, I had one show where I was at the end of a tour. I had a number one record in the country on the club charts, and I was burnt out of the whole making music that wasn't jazz. I was I had this, like, big vocal I had to deliver. It was a big hit. It was an underground hit around the world. I was supposed to show up and be this dynamic powerhouse to track, you know?
Yeah.
So this last show on the tour, I was in LA, which was my hometown at the time. So they sent me a limo, and I got effed up in the limo. I was just, I got, like, I can say this now because I'm 10 years sober, right?
Awesome.
But, like, thank you very much. Yeah, I celebrated last year, last month, and it was a big thing for me, right?
Nice. Yeah.
So there I am. I'm, like, I arrive, and I'm already, like, coming on to everybody and, like, thinking I'm the king, you know. I got the record, you know, let's go, right?
Yeah.
I had a fantastic show in my mind, you know. It was like...
We've all been there.
Yeah, we've all been there, right?
Yeah. And I was like, I call my manager afterwards. I'm like, you should have been here. This was the show, you know. And she's like, yeah, I can hear you're effed up. Like, yeah. So I took the limo home back to Venice Beach, and I come, and I'm like, none of that was real. That was all in my mind. I was beautiful. I was David Bowie. And it was an important turnaround for me. I was like, from here on, I just gotta be real.
Mm-hmm.
That's like the waking up moment, really.
It totally was. And I actually started to quit everything at that point.
That's good. That, you know, I think that's, I remember you told me about this. We were, because every time anyone listens to any Pink Floyd music,
yeah,
they're always like, oh, how high must they have been to come up with it?
Totally.
They, Dark Side of the Moon, they were completely sober the entire time. Like, I've read multiple interviews, and they're all like, we just had that kind of vision. Yeah. We weren't on anything.
Right.
Like,
and their entire point was, you can't write that quality music when you are under the influence of anything.
That's like, right, that's right.
Some people would, like, beg to differ. They're like, oh, no, it can, like, be helpful, which it might, it can be.
Yeah.
But, like, I think for it to have that kind of, like, impact and come from yourself that much, you have to, like, really be in your own head. And
Yeah, I agree.
Let's jump forward a little bit.
Sure.
New York Story.
Sure,
yeah,
man.
Talk to me about the process of coming up with the music on this. Talk to me about how the recording was like, and tell me about the reception you've had touring around with this.
Oh, it would be great. Thank you. Yes, gentlemen, yes. Well, it's weird. I feel like I've been singing these songs all my life now because I wrote the record. My honey was in New York, so I was down there trying to be all romantic, right? Right. And thinking like, New York City, here I come. And I'm like spending all this money trying to like be all romantic. And it was crazy. Anyway, for 8 shows a week, because my now partner was on Broadway. So like for 8 shows a week, I had nothing to do. I was just there kind of waiting for their show to be over. So now I'm like hanging around, being a problem, you know, and like a guy can get in trouble and, you know, being a stage door Johnny in New York at Times Square, like, you know, a lot of stuff to do. So I was like, let me lock myself in a little writing room, like the size of a little tiny studio, you know, no window, just a piano, kind of old school, you know, kept thinking about Cole Porter, Burt Bacharach and the, you know, like, right? Tin Pan Alley.
Yeah.
Like, we need an 11 o'clock number, Cole. Can you deliver by tomorrow morning for Ethel Merman? And like, yes, I can. Yeah. So there I was hacking away, making songs that were about the relationship. And then kind of about New York, because New York got to me, right? Like we were living up in Harlem and right where the Savoy Ballroom used to be, the Apollo Theater still going, where the old Cotton Club was. So the 20s, 30s, Harlem Renaissance stuff. All alive for me. I kept going, what would Fats Waller write about? What would Billy sing about? What, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It was great for me because, like, that's how I came up. I came up, as you know, like slaving to the Billy record and going, what is life? What is life? Oh, it's all expressed in this version of Body and Soul. How will I ever write anything like that?
Yeah.
You know? And then loving the George Gershwin and all the heavyweights, right? So here I was kind of in turmoil emotionally, strapped to a piano in my writing room, you know, and that's how New York Stories came out. It's like a song cycle, you know, the spine of the record is just me falling in love and being really insecure, you know, going, is it going to work out? Am I the man? Am I the man? You know?
Yeah. Did you figure out the answer?
Turned out good.
Yeah.
Turned out I'm the man.
Yeah. It's always great when you can like bring it back to your roots. Cause I know a lot of bands that will like, they have like this certain sound when they start out and they just kind of like evolve. Like you've had like many different kinds of records that come out. And this one, like you brought it right back to what you're first listening to. And
isn't that wild?
You can definitely always like hear the more, like the passion that's actually in there when they bring it back. Like it's fantastic.
Yeah. Like I agree with you. And I watch artists to see like, when are they reconnecting to the soil? Right. Mm-hmm. And when they are, you get the goods.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, really
so
is.
Yeah. And I think it's kind of our job to keep on top of ourselves and see, are we really digging the deepest? So New York Stories ended up being so easy to tour because it's like, all I have to do is just say go and the songs roll out to the people and they're really from a real place. People can feel that, you know?
Would you say then this is almost a summation of that process of getting your feet finally back into the soil after you left the Netherlands?
Absolutely. Like Molly Johnson put me on tour with her when I first came home. She went like, come on, come with me, you know? And she folded me into her, you know, I sang on her record and she put me opening the show and I started to dig into the business here and the music and the players.
Right.
Worked with my brother, Daniel Barnes, who helped me shape what this became. And New York Stories sort of was the moment where the public went, oh, I get you.
Right. Mm-hmm.
You're that jazz crooner guy who also writes his own songs, you know?
Yeah.
And that, we don't have that many of those those of me, you know? Mm-hmm. So that, and it takes a minute for people to get that identity, mm-hmm. and you have to kind of, you know, give them time to get it, you know?
Yeah, like, for sure.
Shall we talk about the national tour?
Yeah.
Let's expand upon
that. Yeah, so how did it lead to the national tour?
Yeah.
Well, you know, it's crazy. You get a record that does well, coast to coast.
Yeah.
And then, you know, you start to talk to the agents and to the promoters, and they're like, well, we think you could do a show. And for me, like, I always think about Canada coast to coast as being like, it's such a challenge, right? There's so much space. Yeah, yeah. You know? But I'm not the guy that does the van tour. Like, I got spoiled in the Nylons, right? So, like, I fly to Halifax, yeah. You know? I'm not. Yeah. And I'm okay with that. You know what I mean? So, like, I feel blessed. Like, I stay in a hotel and I fly to my new town and I sing to a new audience. And they've heard the record from because of you guys, because of radio, mm-hmm. because of smart music freaks, you know, who go, listen to this, you know.
Yeah.
And, like, because jazz is a niche, and we've done our part, like, we met our public with social media. And so, like, a video has happened. Mm-hmm. They've seen it. They know what I sound like. Right. When I come to town, they're, like, either in or they're not,
yeah.
you know.
Yeah.
And, you know, to move that needle with audiences now, they have to really feel you, right? Like, you can't be coming with a whole, like, I'm in town. Doesn't
yeah.
matter, you know? Like, they have to know, like, there's integrity. There's authenticity. Mm-hmm. There's someone they can sign up for the rest of their lives. They're going to be checking in with you to see yeah. what you're doing for them, you know?
Yeah.
And I feel that weight very heavily. So touring is making that relationship real,
right.
you
yeah,
know?
Absolutely. Yeah, for sure.
Well, as we come to the end of the half hour,
yeah.
it's only fitting that I ask you, what's next for Micah Barnes?
Awesome. Well, I have some great news that, for me anyway, I don't know about you guys, I'm coming back to Peterborough.
Nice. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm really happy. I played Market Hall as a fundraiser for a local theater company about a year ago.
Okay.
And we started the conversation with the good folks at Market Hall. So November 30th, my trio and I are going to come and play a show. And I just invite folks to check out the music online and see if you're interested, because we would love to sing for you.
Yeah, for sure.
You know?
Speaking of the music, I suspect we'll now play a song.
Yeah, we're going to be playing a
from
song
from the newest album. And
yeah, this is from New York Stories. This is a song, Starting Tomorrow, is the one we're going to play?
Yes.
Let's start Tomorrow. Yeah. Just
the background. Sure. This is the one where, you know, I was talking about Am I the Man? Mm-hmm. Well, this is the song where I'm pretending to be the man.
Fake it till you make it. You
yeah.
know, just,
yeah. Starting Tomorrow, you're mine.
Yeah.
Starting Tomorrow, it's all about me and
yeah.
you.
Yeah.
That's, I needed, like, a blues song that talked about, like, you know, when you got to put your swagger on because, like, you're just totally vulnerable.
Yeah,
and, like,
yeah.
if I act like this is happening, maybe it's happening.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Well, I'd like to thank you very much for coming
yeah,
on.
Yeah,
all right,
so
Josh. What a pleasure. You guys are awesome. I will come back anytime, hopefully before the Market Hall.
Yeah, for sure.
We'd
yeah.
love to have you back on.
Awesome.
It's been a fantastic time for us. I've learned a lot.
Oh,
yeah.
cool.
You know, because we both are aspiring musicians.
Ah, that's what's going on here.
Yeah.
So we've learned quite a lot in this.
Okay.
Yeah.
Awesome.
So yeah, thank you so much for being on.
Pleasure,
wish
gentlemen.
You well. Wish you good luck in your tour.
Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you. And we'll see you again real soon.
Yeah, we'll hope to have you on the show next year.
That'd be great.
Yeah. All right. Cool.
Starting tomorrow, here's your warning. You're gonna wake up in my arms, beginning each and every morning, changing all my plans. Starting tomorrow, I'm your man. Starting tomorrow, I will be changing. I'm sure that we both got some shit that's gonna take some rearranging. Go on, ask me if I can. Starting tomorrow, I'm your man. Don't worry about the future, we'll think of something. Don't worry about the secrets, I got none of them. You'll never be
starting tomorrow.
Amazing.
I love the drum finish. Yeah. It's fantastic.
I like the intro, the pianos.
Oh yeah, just the whole thing. Really glad that Mika could come in.
Yeah, no, that was a lot.
Everyone
of fun.
Definitely check him out. It's fantastic.
He is a really cool person.
He is,
and I think that really matters when you like a musician, because like if they're really cool and fun,
yeah,
then you want to listen to their music, you want to support them. So go out there and support this guy.
I know a lot of like musicians that I was like, I love their music, but I don't think I would want to meet them in real life because they seem like total jerks.
Right? Like you
don't
want to hang out with them. Like, oh, hang out but with yeah,
if you couldn't tell, which I don't know how you couldn't, but he, like just his personality in the air was fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
So he was just as charismatic off the air too. He's a fantastic person. Definitely check him out. November 30th. Mark your calendars, ladies and gentlemen. It's should be a good time.
Should be.
Should and be it will a be. Good time. Like, I don't see why it wouldn't.
Yeah.
What else do we have to talk about for the rest of this show, Raz?
We have around 25 minutes, I think.
Okay.
To kill, and we got to talk about stuff.
Yeah.
You want to talk about, because we didn't want to talk about it last week, you want to talk about the Chappelle special?
Yes. His two specials a little I think bit? We should talk about that. That Let's came out a little bit ago. What, mm-hmm. what date did that come out?
March 21st, I think
21st. Yeah, March 21st is when that came out.
So it's like a couple weeks now.
A little bit, yeah.
I don't know.
We're
recording this a little bit.
Time's a little weird right now, but we still have that live energy for you guys because we're not editing any mistakes.
Nope.
So
not
yeah,
the levels,
the
nothing.
Chappelle special.
Yes,
it was amazing. What did you think?
I thought it was really good. Listen, when you listen to this 2004 specials,
mm-hmm.
and you listen to them, and you're like, oh, everything he says is super relevant still. And it's like, you kind of take into account that when he said the stuff he was saying, we like in 2017, you listen to it, you're like, oh, yeah, totally. Back then, that's not the reaction a lot of people had.
No.
So he says a lot of stuff now, where like 10 years, you'll be like, of course. But now it's like,
you like
whoa.
Hear it, you're like, ooh, that was a little controversial,
right?
Like, that was a little edgy.
But a lot of stuff is just,
He makes, again, it's loaded with social commentary, right?
Yeah.
A lot of it is just like, it's a critique on just how we are as human beings and how society is. And
so
I think that's
before
cool.
we get into it too much, I feel like there might be some listeners that don't know who Dave Chappelle is.
Yes.
So he's an amazing genius comedian who
yes.
had the Chappelle Show. What is that, 3 seasons that it lasted?
Two.
2 seasons, okay.
And on the third one, he like they signed on for a third season. And he's like he signed a $50 million deal for a third season, and then went to Africa instead.
Yeah, he just like failed.
He just like I'm done.
But in that time, he did 2 specials, which were yeah. For What It's Worth and
Killing Them Softly.
Yeah, I'm not sure which one was first, but
I have no idea.
Can't remember.
And
but
he also did a half-hour HBO special before
yeah.
either of those.
Okay.
And that one was it's really really good one.
He's quite young in them, like
20s. Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Early 20s.
And now. He didn't, like, he wasn't even in the news for a while, and then he would just kind of, like, do shows occasionally, but not really
yeah.
making any news, and then he was on a couple talk shows all
mm-hmm,
of a sudden,
mm-hmm.
and you're like, oh, wow, Chappelle's back, and
yeah.
Netflix was like, he's getting 3 new specials, and they released 2 of them back-to-back, like, the same day.
Yeah. And the next one is going to come out at the end of the year, I believe?
I think so.
Yeah. And I was watching his interview on Jimmy Fallon, and he's like, so why'd you do, 2 back-to-back and, you know, like, the 3 special deal. And he's just like, money. It's like, fair enough. Because, like,
yeah.
he signed a $60 million deal for 3.
Oh, my God.
And those 2 he had already done. Like,
oh, yeah.
Those weren't, like, those specials that he did, like, he was like, yeah, those were, like, I did them. Like, I just recorded them and did them. I just had them. And when they were like, oh, we want you to do 3 specials, he was like, well, I already have 2. Like, here's 2, and we'll do 1 more. And they're like, cool. So he's just, like, literally.
That's amazing.
Yeah, and he's one of those people, and I've always found this really strange with Dave Chappelle, is I've never really seen another comedian or, entertainment personality who, talk about his money so openly. Like, people rarely ever go, like, oh, you just made this much on your deal. Like, how do you feel? And like, I haven't really seen that for other artists.
Yeah, it's true.
And for Chappelle, like, especially when the Chappelle Show, when he signed on for the 3rd season, and they're like, so you're making $50 million for this. What are you going to do? And you could tell he's, like, super uncomfortable. People talking about, like, you know, a young black dude making
yeah.
$50 million is, like, you know.
It's definitely, like, out of his comfort zone
yeah.
for sure.
And he didn't, like, he didn't enjoy people asking about stuff. And that kind of led to his whole breakdown and, like, leaving and everything.
Mm-hmm. But this know. Comeback shows he definitely has it.
Oh.
Like, he has not lost a thing.
Oh, ridiculous.
I was just reading a couple, like, reviews on the specials. And they, like, noted some things that I didn't even think of. But I was like, that's so true.
Mm-hmm.
It's like you never see his punchlines coming. Like,
nope.
Sometimes with a comedian, you're like, oh, that's going to, he's going to say this. And
yeah.
he says it. And you're like, okay, that's still funny, but I saw it coming. But him, he's like completely out of nowhere. He'll just say something. You're like, that was hilarious. And I don't even understand. Like, it's so good.
His comedic timing, though.
Yeah.
It's just like, if you were to just read what he was writing, I don't think you would laugh much.
No.
But just the way he says it and like
yeah.
the energy he brings.
And like his
ridiculous.
Inflection. Because he does a lot of like, impressions of white people and
yeah,
when he puts on his white person voice, it's like that just makes it like
yeah.
it's fantastic.
I don't know if any of our friends are listening right now, but his white person voice is just like James Caldwell.
Yes.
Who's enjoying sunny France right now. Shout out to James. He's not definitely not listening.
Should
but,
listen to us. Well,
yeah, no, when I first met James and I heard him laugh especially, I was like, you are who Chappelle mimics. Right. You're the guy. Good to know.
I didn't even think of that, but you're so right.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Which special did you like better? The first or second one?
I liked the first one, which was what was it? The Age of Spin. That was the first one that Netflix released. It was
yeah.
the both were hilarious, but that one, I don't know. Maybe it's because it was the first I watched, but
mm-hmm.
there was just so much in it that was just perfect.
Yeah. I think for me, there were more moments in the first one where I laughed just hysterically.
Yeah.
And there were more moments in the second one where I'm like, I really want to know what he says about this. You
yeah.
know? I didn't laugh as much in the second one, but the second one was very captivating
yeah.
in its own way. So that was a cool thing that happened.
Mm-hmm. Chappelle's specials, everyone. Check them out. They're just on Netflix.
Imagine we get Dave Chappelle on here one day.
I think it'll happen.
In little Peterborough, in his little studio.
Yeah.
He's playing Market Hall. Can you imagine?
Can you imagine Dave Chappelle doing Market Hall?
No.
No, I can't. No. The tickets.
Chappelle in Peterborough? No. Absolutely never. No, not at all.
I'm gonna tweet at him till he comes now. Just to spite
you. People
you.
Last Sunday downtown talking about white pride, white
oh,
power.
Oh, yeah.
Remember that?
Do we want to talk about that?
Yeah, let's talk about that.
That's messed up.
It's kind of silly. It is kind of silly. What are your opinions on that?
Okay. I'm going to open up with saying not good, but I'm going to follow it up with something more interesting. So a lot of people, I read this article, and I was like, that's what I've been saying. Like, well, it's they articulated what I was thinking but couldn't put into words. Right. And some other people were like, oh, that's an interesting perspective. But what it was is people were like, stop calling it a rally. It was literally two people. And a lot of people are writing on Facebook, they're like, oh, man, what's this city coming to? And it's like, do you know
where we are?
It's like, yeah, but also like, it was five people, and 1,000 people shared it, being like, this is wrong.
Yeah.
Like, you can't be like, what's this city coming to based on a couple of people with this messed up ideology? Like, it's, so, like, I understand. It's the worst. It's terrible. It doesn't make any sense. It's not good people.
Mm-hmm.
But you can't be like, this rally is everything that's wrong with Peterborough. It's like, it's a couple. It's not even a rally.
No.
Like, you can't even call it a rally. It was a gathering of a couple guys.
Also, as someone who isn't white, I think I can say this. I don't think white people can say this.
Yeah.
Because, like, I think if you're white and you look at that and you're like, well, they're just practicing free speech, people will be like, all right, come on now. You can't say that. But, like,
yeah.
I believe, like you know, as someone who isn't white, so I'm qualifying this, I don't care what your skin is, well, your race, none of that matters. Malfunction there for a second. None of that matters. But, like, if you have opinion you believe in strongly and you want to, you know, have a platform to say it, then you should be allowed that platform to say it, even if your message is incredibly ignorant and wrong and racist and all types of ways.
Just not anything beyond the actual speech is
exactly
what you mean. Okay, yeah,
you should be able to say it. You shouldn't use any type of force, of course, and if you are specifically targeting people, I believe that's wrong. I believe if you're actively trying to hurt someone, then that is wrong. But if your entire thing is, oh, these are things I believe in, and, you know, this is a platform I'm going to choose to say my stuff on, I don't, of course, I don't agree with it.
It's an edgy, it's an edgy thing to say.
I don't agree with it. But you should be allowed to have that platform just so people who know better can be like, here's why you're wrong.
Yeah, no, exactly.
Because if those people
if you keep your ignorance hidden, it'll just stay there.
Exactly. And you'll spread it to the people around you. Like, you're going to have, your next four generations are going to have that ignorance. So speak out and be like, you know, this is how I feel. And then engage in discourse. Engage in people being like, this is why you're wrong. And have an open enough mind to be like, all right, let's talk about this. These are things I believe. And, you know, I don't, like, again, no one's born racist. No one's born bigoted. These are things that are put into children and adults. And these are things that, because they're put into us, they can be taken out of us as well.
Yep.
And I truly believe in the power of education, the power of discourse, and the power of just talking to someone and being like, instead of getting angry. Like, when I saw that, right? When I saw that people were being like, oh, you know, what's happening to our country? Because there's people who are there protesting. They're like, what's happening to Peterborough? So many foreigners, blah, blah, blah. White power, all that type of stuff. Like, I wasn't angry when I saw that. I was just like, I just want to talk to them.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I really just want to have a conversation with one of the people. Just be like, all right, let's talk it out. What do you feel and why do you feel it? And
yeah, like,
let's
see what's going on. What made you believe in this kind of thing?
Exactly.
Because, like, I honestly, like, don't know where such a thing would come from. It must be like parents something
absolutely.
Like that. Like,
parents, media for a lot of it. When you create fear, like, you know, media plays a huge role in doing that. And it's just born out of ignorance and it's born out of naivety. And, like, if you see someone like that, don't get angry. It's again, like, I know it's not like our initial reaction is to get angry.
Yeah, like, it kind of makes sense to get like angry. Like, why does this still have to be a thing?
Yeah.
But
you can be disgusted by it. Like,
oh yeah,
you're totally disgusted by it, and like, it's totally wrong. But when you do see someone like that, whether it's on the street or whether it's online, because there are many times where I've seen people say certain things online, and I'm like, well, you know, that's not, you can't really have that thing. That's a wrong type of view to have.
Yeah.
But you shouldn't tackle that by trying to undermine them for it. You should be like, well, okay, let's talk about this. Because if you try to undermine them, then they're just going to be like, oh.
Like, you know? Too many people just immediately go on offense and just attack these people.
Exactly.
Being like, hey, you can't do this. And blah, blah, blah. It's like, you're right. But it's not going to accomplish anything to actually do that.
Absolutely.
That's the big thing.
It's ultimately, what do you want to do? Do you want to eliminate the problem or do you just want to have a place to rant? You know?
Yeah.
So if you want to really eliminate the problem, you got to control your anger. You got to control that disgust. You got to talk to them. And you got to be like, all right, let's talk about why you think the way you think. And let's talk about why you're wrong.
And if you want to have a place to rant, start a blog or something. You know,
start a blog. Start, get on radio.
Yeah. That's how we got our start.
That's the entire point of our show.
Yeah.
That was a while ago, too, though. That was like, by the time this show comes out.
Yeah, that would have been a little bit ago. Hopefully something would have happened about this.
There was another one.
Oh, man.
I like to people listen to, like, there was one last week. What are they talking about?
These guys are way off. Yeah. But yeah, so that was the thing that happened.
That was the thing that happened. I saw that and I was like, I've had an instance or two of racial abuse in Peterborough. Like when I first came to Peterborough, I was scared. I was like, oh, you know, people are going to undermine me because I'm brown, blah, blah, blah. And I was really scared. And like, for like a year and a half, it was like the nicest place in the world. And then like, I remember outside a Whistle Stop, some dude was like, go back to India. And I was like, first of all, first of all, not from India. None of my family's from India. Second of all, what do you mean go back? I can't, like, you're, at least get it right. You're racist on two, first of all, you're racist on the fact that you're from another country, so go back to where you came from. Second of all, you got the place where I'm from wrong. Like, that's double, like, I can't, it was just like, dude, this is ridiculous. You can't, it's just, yeah.
Aziz Ansari, this is a while ago, he hosted SNL, and right. In the opening monologue he did, he said something of that sort. He's like, I think he was the first person to host after Trump's inauguration. So he's like, people are using this to kind of like, he's like, he called it the lowercase KKK. He's like, because they're not actually doing much. They're just kind of like using verbal things. He's like, they're like telling people, hey, go back to Africa. And then look at me and say, go back to where you came from. Like, he's like, people, they don't even know. Like, if you're going to be racist, get your facts straight.
Like, seriously, if that guy was like, go back to Pakistan or go back to Thailand, I'd be like, all right, you know what? Props to you.
Clearly did his research.
Right? Like, you're an educated racist. Those are strange. Those are hard to come by. Yeah. Like, if you're educated and a racist, that's, you know, like, I'll have a conversation with you at that point. But when you're just like, oh, back to India,
there's,
I'm like,
no talking to these people.
Like, come on. Get it right. Like, yeah. Like, there's not just, at least he wasn't like, go back to Africa. Could you imagine if he said that?
Yeah. Like, that's just,
well, yeah, but that was like,
ignorance to a whole new level.
It happened a while ago, though, and it hasn't been anything since.
Yeah.
Not that I know of, anyway, so.
I'm really not at a place to speak, being very white, but Peterborough's my last name is white.
Literally.
But Peterborough seems to be, like, a not bad, like, of a place.
Absolutely.
For being, like, 95% white ridiculous. People, it's, yeah. like, not...
No.
It's fairly good.
I've thought about that, and I wonder if that's because of the areas we hang around. Like, right, you know, around possibly, Trent and
yeah,
George.
Because it's
like,
very liberal areas that exactly, we end up hanging right? around in.
This
yeah.
is, like, very, these are university areas. So maybe it's part of that. But, I don't know. I think a lot of people in general, like, one of our best friends and, like, one of our favorite people is Evan Fantine.
Oh, yeah.
And he's from Englehart, town of 1,500 people. And that's, like, traditionally, you would think that if they're going to be people who have certain views that aren't looked greatly upon, you know, they're going to be from a really small city because that's just the stereotype.
Yeah.
And he's the nicest, most accepting human being in the world.
Oh, yeah.
And I found that to be true for people who come from all types of small cities. They're just the nicest, open-minded people. And it's in the people who are, like, from Toronto and Ottawa, like, people who come from, like, bigger cities who tend to be a little standoffish and, you know, untrustworthy.
Yeah, like, it just proves that it's, you can change these, like, ideologies. Like, even
absolutely.
If... Because there was probably people from where Evan was from that were like that, and
oh, for sure.
they probably just people like went online helps with it a lot, because that like it's Marshall McLuhan's Global Village brings everything together, but people can go online and be like, oh, this isn't an okay thing, and then that kind of just gets passed around, and it you can get these tiny little towns that are very progressive, and it's fantastic.
Absolutely. And I think that's really cool, because the more we can get that ingrained into the fabric of our society, the better. You know, just the message of acceptance and message of, like, hey, we're basically the same.
Yeah.
Like, we're literally, come on, like, it's not
race
much.
Is a construct.
Race only began in, like, the 1600s when colonialism was starting.
Yeah.
Like, there was no such thing as race before that. Like, people think that race has just been around forever. Like, it hasn't.
No.
The idea of race only started when the Spanish and the English were like, let's go to these other countries and destroy them so that we can keep fighting our feudal wars.
They're like, what? How can we, like, justify this? And they're like, can we say they're different than us? And they're like, all right.
Yeah. Like, subhuman because it looked different, and like that's what they did. And like, it's even worse in North America, because at least in Europe, racism was born out of like those people away, like in other countries are different, and you know, they are who we will subjugate. But in North America, it was because of slavery, right? So race was a part of the interconnected society in that time. So when race has evolved in Europe, it's evolved in like a, oh, people from that part of the world, as opposed to North America, where it's like all these people in our society who are beneath us. And that's a lot more toxic, you know? And
yeah, it's true.
Especially in the States. And not as much in Canada, I don't think, in terms of black people. Like, I think in terms of Native history, there's a lot to be said. And I'm not the person to say it because I don't know
much. Yeah, we should have Rashawn.
We should have Rashawn, yeah. But yeah, in terms of race, it's really tough, you know, because it is an institutional, systematic thing.
And it's like internal othering, which is like a thing that takes place, which just makes no sense.
It makes no sense.
Yeah.
And it's not even like, I'm not even saying like, oh, it's us, the university educated students who feel this way, and it's you guys who don't. No. Like, the amount of times I'll get on a plane and I'll see a bearded brown guy in like an entire, you know, Arabic outfit, and I was like, for a second, I'll be like, oh. Like, because I'm just so used to the West, like that Western media thing of like, they'll show you someone and they'll associate like a terrible thing with it. And like, for a split second, like, because I'm so used to that, I'll be like, oh, and I'll be like, what am I talking about? Like, that's so stupid. What am
like,
I doing?
It's definitely not what your initial thought is, but like, how are you reacting?
Exactly.
To that? Like, because you can see things like, oh, man. And then you're like, oh, media, right. Yeah, I'm a little bit brainwashed. And, like, it's just ingrained into there. Yeah.
It sucks to acknowledge that too. Like, no one wants to acknowledge you're racist unless you're one of those people who does, I suppose.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I don't know. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, because it's tough to acknowledge that kind of thing because I don't want to be like, yeah, no, I'm a little bit racist because I'm like, I'm not.
Yeah.
I do not have that kind of ideology, but I assume just in every single everyday things I do, I probably have little bits of that getting in there, which is unfortunate, but I think everyone does, which is not good, because they don't even realize they're doing it, really.
No. And, like, I don't know, that initial racist response, I suppose, and when I say racist response, I don't mean, like, you are racist to someone. I mean, like, your internal, like, brain, like,
gives for sure, thing.
And I'm not saying everyone's like that. I'm saying, you know, I'm sure there are some people who aren't like that, but then there's also, like, the amount of times I've seen people who will be super, like, lovey and, like, oh, let's include everyone. But then the way they do it is so patronizing to minorities, right?
Yeah.
Like, you might have met people who are like, oh, your people have it so tough and our people, blah, blah, blah. And you're like, I get that your intent is cool, but you're being so patronizing right now.
Being
like, oh, are you hurt, little one? Your people, they've been, you know, it's like
let me, a superior being, help you out a little bit.
Yeah,
like, it's not okay.
Yeah, no. That's basically what we had after World War II, right? That's development theory.
Oh, yeah.
That's what development theory is. Development theory was just like, these people need our help to make them to the proper standards. And like, we'll go in there and do stuff for them.
We decide what normal is, and we're going to make them that
way.
Exactly,
yeah. Like,
and it's not how... No. Yeah.
What do you think about colonialism? Loaded question.
I am conflicted.
Conflicted.
Because it's not a good thing.
No.
But I wouldn't exist without it.
Good point.
So that's my confliction.
Good point.
Because I quite like existing, because then I get to listen to music and stuff and have a cool radio show.
True.
So yeah, it's not a good thing that it happened, but it happened, and I am going to just... We just have to deal with it, and people have to understand that it was a bad thing.
Yeah, absolutely.
They can't be like, no, colonialism's... It made me here, and it made America what it is. No. No.
No. No, it didn't.
No. Just... No.
That's why it's so annoying. Like, it's so strange when you see people, like, they'll have Confederate flags, and they're like, it's not about race and war, it's about heritage. And you're like, no, it is not.
No.
Because the Confederate flag, that particular flag, was the flag of the army, had nothing to do with the Confederate States at all. There were 13 different flags, and that flag represented none of those states. It represented the specific army that was going out to fight for slavery.
Yeah.
And it's like, that it's nothing to do with heritage at all. Like, you're not your heritage does not go back to an army. That's not how this works.
What I find that blows my mind is people in Canada will have little Confederate flags on their vehicles, and I'm like, what? There's so much wrong, because that was not our thing.
No, not
and at all. You're a bad person, and you don't understand history, and I'm like, there's just so much wrong with seeing that.
The Confederate flag is just a silliest, like. I just don't understand why people don't take a second. Like, if you really want to acknowledge your heritage, I'm happy, like, do that. Heritage is very, very important.
Oh, yeah.
But actually acknowledge your heritage then. Like, use a flag of one of the Confederate states that your heritage belongs to, not the army that they put together, because that's not heritage at all. Like, you can't, like, imagine, like, oh, what's your race? Where what's your ethnicity? I come from the British Empire, the army. The Navy is really my heritage. It doesn't make sense. Like, yeah, anyway. I suspect we're running out of time.
Yeah, this took quite the turn.
We ranted
I'm glad we're getting our shows in previous weeks have just been nonsense.
They
have been. This weekend, last week even, we talked about feminism quite a bit. We're pretty good.
Yeah. I'm we're going to get in trouble one of these days for saying something, aren't we?
Oh, yeah. But probably. If we get in trouble for what we're saying, I don't care about who we're getting in trouble with.
I agree entirely.
Yeah.
I agree entirely. How do you want to play out? How do you want to do this? How do you want to do this?
Do you want to throw a... Do you want to throw another Mika song?
Let's throw another Mika song.
Let's do it. So we're going to throw another Mika song on. Let's throw... let's just pick one here. Let's play the song... Ooh, I'll play a French-sounding one.
Yes.
La Rouge ou la Noire. Ooh. And then in parentheses, the roulette wheel.
The roulette wheel. Isn't that... What does noir mean?
Black.
Black. The red or the black? What?
Roulette. Oh. Like roulette, red and black. Oh, that's clever. Mika's quite the guy. So yeah, we're going to play that song. And we hope you guys enjoy it. And we will have another show for you next week.
Yep, probably.
And it might have some exciting stuff on it. Who knows?
Who knows?
I hope you enjoyed this.
Hope you guys stay woke.
And have a nice.
I'm ready. Let's spin. I'm tempting the gods, betting the odds on La Rouge ou la Noire. I am not a gambling man. I've lost the game before. You have made this fool so brave. My heart's down on the board. My future's on the black or red. Your kiss to beg or borrow. If the fates are kind and luck is good, I'll have all your sweet tomorrow. I'm ready, let's spin the roulette wheel. Got my chips down. I like the dizzy way that I feel when you're in. My head starts to spin like a roulette wheel, and my poor heart pounds. Maybe you, why not you, could be you. Only the stars know La Rouge ou la Noire. The roulette wheel goes around. A man must recognize his chance and seize the moment fast. Win or lose, the gods will choose, but now the dice are cast. If the ball lands on the number two, your heart is mine to borrow. If the fates are good and luck is kind, I'll have all your sweet tomorrow. The Le Rouge ou Le Noir.